The problem with talking to the Taliban today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A top U.S. diplomat says he's made progress toward a peace agreement in Afghanistan, but some Afghans don't see negotiating with the Taliban as a good thing.
I was witness of all this war and conflict, and now at the hand that we give them an award to the Taliban that you are coming and want to make peace with us, you must go to hell. That is their problem.
Also, 3 days after a dam collapse outside a mine in Brazil, relatives of the missing are waiting in limbo for answers.
The families who still don't know what's happened to their loved ones, they are in a total nightmare state right now.
Plus, adopting a dog from Chernobyl? Yes, it is possible. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for being with us this Monday. A peace plan for Afghanistan. If true, that's a welcome headline. After 17 years of war, though, there is reason to be skeptical. A peace plan is what the U.S. Special Envoy for Afghanistan is talking about right now. Zalmay Khalilzad has been negotiating with the Taliban for months. Today, he said the Trump administration and Taliban leaders have agreed on a framework for peace. Meanwhile, Ashraf Ghani, the president of the U.S.-backed Afghan government, is not ready to celebrate yet. The Taliban has two choices, President Ghani said earlier today in a televised address. Either they sit down for talks with the Afghan government or continue working for Afghanistan's enemies. The World's Shirin Jafari has been following the story and is with me. Laid out for us, Shirin, what has been agreed to and what is yet to be worked out?
These latest rounds of talk, Marco, has been taking place in Qatar, the Persian Gulf country. That's because the Taliban has a political office in Doha. And the U.S. and the Taliban spent 6 days hashing out this framework that Zalmay Khalilzad is now talking about. And something that the Taliban seems to have agreed on is a demand from the U.S. that the Taliban would not allow extremist groups to use Afghanistan, the territory, to launch attacks against the U.S. in the future.
Right. And this was the strong belief back in 2001 that Osama bin Laden had been given access to the mountains of Afghanistan to plan attacks against the U.S., including the 9/11 attack. But how can the Taliban guarantee that they can keep extremists from using Afghanistan as a staging base?
Right. And that's one of the key issues. And there are so many details that still need to be worked out.
So run down the list of things that were discussed at this meeting in Doha.
Taliban sources have said that there was an agreement that foreign troops will leave Afghanistan within 18 months. I haven't seen that confirmed from the U.S. side, so I'm not sure about that. Then there was the point of what role the Taliban will play in Afghanistan after the U.S. leaves. Then there's the question of prisoner exchange. The Taliban would release some prisoners in exchange for U.S. doing the same thing. And that was also debated.
Yeah, I mean, those are some really complex questions. And that last one, any idea who those prisoners might be exchanged for?
We don't know for sure, but there were two men, one American and one Australian, who were abducted in Kabul in 2016. And they were employees of the American University of Afghanistan. So they could be released in exchange for Taliban prisoners.
So we've been talking, Shirin, about what the Taliban and the U.S. have been negotiating, but so far no mention of the Afghan government. Why not?
Yeah, so, and that's a really crucial point, Marco. So the Taliban's position has always been that it will not negotiate with the Afghan government. It says the Afghan government was put in place by the Americans and other foreign powers, and so it's not a legitimate government, and that's why they were not present at these talks. And frankly, the Afghans feel sidelined. The U.S. Special Envoy, Zalmay Khalilzad, was back in Kabul this weekend to brief Ashraf Ghani, the president, about what was discussed in Qatar. And today, in his speech, Ashraf Ghani said that, you know, we do want peace, but it has to be done in a thoughtful way.
Yeah, what exactly are the Afghans worried about?
Okay, so when the Taliban was in power in the 1990s, it placed some of the harshest most oppressive rules on women.
Right.
It also has killed thousands and thousands of Afghans. You know, the group basically has blood on its hands. And so just imagine all of a sudden the U.S. is telling Afghans that we are going to make peace with the Taliban. And by the way, we are just going to leave in a short amount of time. I mean, that doesn't make Afghans feel very
confident. Not a lot of confidence, yeah.
And so you get reactions like the one I got from Mary Akrami. She's a prominent women's rights activist.
This is really ridiculous. This is not acceptable at all. And particularly to the women of Afghanistan, and particularly to us. Like, I was witness of all this war and conflict. And now at the hand that we give them an award to the Taliban that you are coming and want to make peace with us, they must go to hell. That is their problem.
Wow. Mary Akrami there. She sounds really unhappy about all of this.
Yeah, she doesn't see things really working out in favor of Afghans and especially Afghan women. So overall, there are a lot of concerns among Afghans about where these talks are leading. And just to be clear, the Afghans want peace too. Mm. They have buried too many family members, friends, neighbors. They want peace too, but they say they don't want this to be rushed and they don't want their country to be thrown into chaos after the U.S. leaves.
A framework for peace in Afghanistan, but with lots of caveats. The world's Shirin Jafari, thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
Recovering from war is a generational struggle anywhere, certainly the story for so many families from Syria. Wafa Mustafa is a 28-year-old from Syria. Her father is missing. The war forced Wafa to leave her home country. She's now in Berlin, but she still wants to know what happened to her father. Berlin-based reporter Holly Young has spent time with Wafa in the German capital. And she and I spoke about Wafa's story.
I first met Wafa at one of the rallies of a group called Families for Freedom. They are a group of families who are related to people who have been forcibly disappeared in Syria and are campaigning for this to be recognized.
And this is a cause that is personal for Wafa. Describe the scene at one of these rallies, these protests in Berlin, that Wafa stages with other Syrian refugees.
Sure, so this group takes part in lots of different types of rallies, and one of these that I met Wafa at was at the Brandenburg Gate, in a very kind of busy touristy spot in the centre of Berlin. Family members of the disappeared were kind of standing around in a circle and each of them holding a framed picture of one of their loved ones which have been forcibly disappeared. And Wafa was there holding a picture of her father.
I think the most difficult question today was like, so are all these people the families of the ones in the pictures? And I was like, no, this is my father, my own father. And like that, this moment is really difficult. Like, no, Wafa, you cannot cry today. It's just hard to say that this is my father. And I don't know, it's hard to say it out loud.
To fully grasp Wafa's emotions, Holly, I want you to take us back to Syria and Wafa's life years ago. What was life like for her before the war started in 2011?
So Wafa grew up in a city in northwestern Syria. She belonged to a kind of relatively comfortable, kind of wealthy family. Her dad ran a frozen vegetable business. Her father was very politically engaged, particularly with the Palestinian cause. So she kind of describes growing up very much surrounded by this sort of activism. Her father actually named her Wafa after the Palestinian news agency.
The news agency is called Wafa?
That's right, yeah. She really grew up kind of idolizing, I think, her father and the kind of activism he was doing.
So 2011 comes along and the Arab Spring, the Arab Awakening. And I suppose for Wafa and her family, it seemed totally natural to go out in the streets of Syria and protest the Assad regime. How dangerous was that, though? And did they know the level of danger they were getting into?
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously Wafa had grown up in a politically aware family. So things like enforced disappearances and detention and arbitrary arrests were not things that started happening out of the blue after 2011. She'd grown up kind of feeling that something was deeply wrong in her country. And so this felt like a moment of real possibility and hope. She showed me a YouTube video with her and a friend sort of chanting to crowds through the megaphone. And you can hear in these clips the absolute passion and excitement of those moments to push for a different Syria that, you know, had justice and the rule of law and these freedoms.
I mean, we know now that that hopeful moment did not last very long. For Wafo, when did that moment of hope seem to be looking more and more hopeless?
In 2011, she was arrested briefly for being involved in a protest. And then particularly in 2013, she told me she'd seen lots of friends disappear and be killed. One of her best friends was shot during a protest. So that really, I think, hit her very hard. And from that point on, I think things became more complicated.
So Wafa's father was arrested, and that was pretty much the last time she spoke or saw him. What happened?
Essentially, the family became a little bit fragmented around that time. So her mother was back home in her hometown, and her father was spending a bit of time in Damascus where they had a flat.
And then one day he called my mom and said, well, it has been like a long time since we spent time together. What about you come to Damascus? So my mom said yes.
So she made her way to Damascus, and by the time she arrived at the flat, he was gone, and the flat was destroyed. And yeah, that's the last the family has heard of him.
What did they do once they found out like he wasn't home and didn't seem to be coming home?
They don't have any explicit reasons of why he was arrested or taken, but
my dad knew that he might be arrested. And this is why he told me, if I get arrested, the only thing that I want you to do that to take your mom and sisters and leave the country. I know that they will come after you.
Within a week of him disappearing, the family were in Turkey. So they made their way to the Turkish border, taking nothing but their passports with them. Once she arrived in Turkey, she went into a period of depression, but eventually she had to get a job to help support the family.
And when did Wafa get to Berlin?
Rafa arrived in Turkey in mid-2013 and arrived in Berlin in March 2016.
How is she doing now? Because she sounded, I wouldn't exactly say upbeat, but she sounded like she has a mission, like she's determined when we heard her earlier.
I think, you know, now she's in Berlin.
I love Berlin. Berlin is the first city I love after Damascus.
She's studying politics and economics. She has her own group of friends here. She's a very active person. But, you know, I think, as it must be for many displaced Syrians, it's a very fraught experience. And really, the impact these disappearances have on families is they're really living with this massive shadow across their lives where they can't grieve properly for losing these people because they just have no answers. One thing that is helping her deal with that is to really plunge a lot of energy into making sure that it's estimated to be over 95,000 people that have disappeared.
Wow.
In Syria, you know, making sure that these are recognised, and even if it's not now, that at some point there is some justice and answers for the hundreds of thousands of families that have to live with empty seats at the dinner table and having no idea what has happened to their families.
So you just threw out some numbers there, 95,000 disappeared and hundreds of thousands of families. That makes sense. I mean, where do those numbers come from and how do we know that?
The exact numbers, for obvious reasons, are very difficult to pin down. But the Syrian Network for Human Rights, which is a civil society organization, that's the number that they estimate, although they suggest it could be many more.
Holly Young, a reporter based in Berlin, telling us about Wafa Mustafa, who, after 5 years, is still holding out hope that her disappeared father in Syria will be found. Holly, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
To see photos of Wafa Mustafa and scenes from that rally for Syria's disappeared in Berlin, go to The World's Instagram page. We are at PRI The World. Coming up later on The World, Venezuela is locked in a political crisis. Two men claiming to be the only legitimate president of Venezuela. There is the socialist leader, Nicolas Maduro, re-elected last year in a disputed vote. Juan Guaido is the opposition leader and the head of the General Assembly, who last week proclaimed himself the interim president. The U.S. immediately recognized Guaido, and many Venezuelans cheered. Many, but not all.
We have plenty of examples where U.S. interventions, whether Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, or anywhere in Central America, have proven to be disastrous for the country and for the region.
More of my conversation with Venezuelan historian Miguel Tinker Salas coming up in a few minutes. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. The families who know that their relatives are dead are considered the lucky ones in Brazil right now. At least 300 people are still missing after a dam collapsed in Brazil's southeastern city of Brumadinho on Friday. 60 people are confirmed dead. Many victims' families are blaming the mining company that built the dam for the disaster. Shannon Sims is a journalist in Rio de Janeiro.
So the company is called Vale, and they are just a really huge mining company in Brazil, a very dominant in the market. And the president actually did a press conference that did not strike survivors and their families very well, where he said, you know, we're not sure what happened and we're not sure who's responsible. That did not strike a good chord with Brazilians, who are pretty clear that they know who's responsible, which is the company who was operating the dam. So what's going on now is we're seeing a lot of demand for answers, and also the government is starting to hold that company accountable in a new way than we've seen in Brazil in the past. And so the Justice Ministry has actually demanded that money be set aside already now, be frozen from the company's assets in order to save it for compensating families.
What is the connection between the dam and this Vale mine?
Oh, well, Vale, they kind of run everything in the state. I mean, to be perfectly honest, ultimately, they are the core actor. And although the details and the legal details of who was responsible for operating and who did the construction and all of this are going to be major issues in the lawsuits that definitely will come from this, ultimately, the buck stops with Vale. And I don't think that anybody has any doubt about that.
So how many of the victims from this dam burst and the people who are still missing, how many of them are miners or employees of Vale?
So what happens in these towns, and I actually have spent time reporting on, not long ago, there was a similar mine collapse in the same state, in a town that was very similar to Brumadinho, called Mariana. And what happens in these towns is essentially, or they're kind of like company towns, where the reason why you live there is because the main employer is Vale. And so most people have some connection to the company, whether that is that they mow the lawn at the company, or they're an executive at the company, or their husband is, or their wife is, or their daughter is. And so everyone there has some connection in general to the company. Who exactly was employed at the time of the mining collapse, we're still figuring out. But yes, certainly many employees will have lost their lives as a result of this.
So this really disturbing search for victims is going to conclude at some point. What's going to happen then?
So there's a river that flows through the town and continues through the state. And we're already seeing the mud reach that river. And what happens, what we saw happen in Mariana, is once the mud got into the river, essentially what happened was you had a secondary disaster with this toxic sludge being carried throughout the riverside and damaging all of the environmental areas and killing off all of the fish and anything that's living from the river. And so that's kind of what we assume is going to happen next, is that the sludge doesn't just stop there. It's going to seep into the riverways. And so be looking for headlines that are going to be calculating the amount of environmental damage that's coming down the pipe.
We've heard a lot about the new president, Jair Bolsonaro of Brazil, deregulating environmental protections. Should we expect a tougher approach toward mining companies?
I think so. I think that it's overdue in Brazil to have a conversation about creating proper infrastructure to protect Brazilians. I really hope that this is the only wake-up call, the last wake-up call that's needed to have that happen. But I should say that as we are speaking, Bolsonaro is in the middle of a 9-hour surgery to take out a colostomy bag that is from the injury that he sustained during his campaign for president when he was stabbed in the stomach.
Right.
So people have not exactly been pressuring him for a response because everyone knows he's in the middle of this delicate surgery. But I think in the next week, he will probably be making an announcement of exactly what kind of consequences he's looking for.
Journalist Shannon Sims in Rio de Janeiro, thanks very much for your time today, Shannon.
Thank you so much, Marco.
It's not just Brazil. Mining companies have a troubling track record in a number of countries: Colombia, Indonesia, Congo, Australia. In all those places, there's concern that the mining industry is harming both its workers and their communities. Patricia Jurowitz tracks the human and environmental impact of the mining industry for the nonprofit Responsible Sourcing Network.
I think gold mining is especially atrocious because of the arsenic that's used. But mercury and cadmium are other toxic chemicals that are released into wastewater. It can pollute drinking water. It can pollute the watersheds and agricultural land, as well as then the huge spill that we saw in Brazil, where you have tailings, things that come out of the land. All that is stored in big containment lakes. We've seen it in Brazil, but we're also seeing it in Canada and U.S.
So in terms of responsible environmental protections when you're mining, is the U.S. supposed to be a world leader in this?
Yes, the United States is supposed to be a world leader in this. And because you now have more mining happening or happening in more difficult environments, that is having a negative impact on many local communities. In the last 20 years, over 50% of the gold is coming from traditional territories of indigenous people. Their whole environment is being turned upside down.
You know, I was just looking at Sebastião Salgado's photographs from a Brazilian gold mine in the mid-1980s, really artisanal gold mining, and the images really are nothing short of hell on earth. In 2019, though, are human rights abuses in the world of mining more nuanced?
I wouldn't necessarily say that they're nuanced. I think that we're all very clear with what the human rights abuses are. I've in particular been working on conflict minerals coming out of the Democratic Republic of Congo, where revenues from mining fund rape, child soldiers, enslave people to work in the mines. This has all been going on for decades. I applaud the electronics industry now going in and certifying some of those mines as conflict-free. But when you have something like gold that is so valuable and so small, the mining and the smuggling of it is still very much commonplace.
I mean, I'd love for you to tell us how to solve this problem, but I know, I mean, your organization, the Responsible Sourcing Network, is looking at it, but how do you even begin to solve issues within this industry? Because it does seem kind of tangled and layered. What problems do you try to deal with first?
Dealing with the pollution of mining is one thing. So yes, in the United States, we have OSHA and we have lots of regulation. Many other countries don't have those regulations, or if they have those regulations, they're not enforced at all. And we need to make sure that those people are both rewarded appropriately as well as taken care of so their lives are not in peril.
Patricia Jurowitz with Responsible Sourcing Network, thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much.
I'm Marco Werman. Venezuela is in a political crisis, and by recognizing an opposition figure as a legitimate president of the country, the U.S. and other nations have taken a clear stand. Some Venezuelans welcome that move. Others are troubled by it.
This is a crisis for Venezuelans to resolve, not a crisis for others to resolve.
That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The White House sent a warning to Venezuela over the weekend. It said the U.S. will respond if there is any violence or intimidation against U.S. diplomats in Venezuela or against the opposition leader Juan Guaido, now recognized by the U.S. as the president of the country. As for Nicolas Maduro, the Trump administration is calling him the former president of an illegitimate mafia state. The words of the White House there. Maduro still has the crucial support of the Venezuelan military, and today he spoke to some of those troops as they prepared for training exercises. Maduro said the American empire is attacking the army, trying to divide the military forces, but he said it's not working. For his part, opposition leader Juan Guaido, the man that the Trump administration supports in Venezuela, had this message for the military.
Soldado de la patria de Venezuela, hoy te doy una orden.
Soldiers of the Venezuelan homeland, today I give you an order. Do not open fire on the people of Venezuela. Do not shoot those who have clearly and constitutionally come out to defend your family, your people, your work, and your livelihood.
Venezuelan historian Miguel Tinker Salas says foreign powers are meddling in his country, deepening the crisis.
It's obvious that Mr. Guaido had traveled abroad, met with leaders in Colombia, the U.S., and we know that Canada played a significant role as well. And it's unfortunate because I think the key thing Venezuela needs is negotiations and peaceful engagement to find a solution to the current crisis. Again, we have plenty of examples where U.S. interventions, whether Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, or anywhere in Central America, have proven to be disastrous for the country and for the region.
How unusual do you think it is for the U.S. and all of these countries to throw their endorsement of someone, Juan Guaido, who just went ahead and declared himself president?
It's another form of a constitutional coup, where by citing a certain article in the Constitution and claiming that Maduro is unfit to perform the duties of president, that now becomes the criteria by which, in this case, opposition or foreign countries can move to replace a president. I think that the issues in Venezuela are grave, are serious. Maduro has a significant amount of blame. But then again, this is a crisis for Venezuelans to resolve, not a crisis for others to resolve.
You mentioned the Constitution. Doesn't the Venezuelan Constitution lay out precisely what should happen in this sort of scenario, and isn't it being followed?
That Constitution says that if he is incapacitated, and there's no evidence that he is incapacitated, now we're betting on the military. Guaido and his followers were providing the military over the weekend with their amnesty clause. They're betting on the military as the principal arbiter in this society. I am not a fan of the Venezuelan military, either under Maduro or anybody else. The military's role in Venezuela has been disastrous, as have military governments elsewhere in Latin America. So I think betting on the military undermines the very notions of democracy. But again, that's what's being done. They're betting on splits within the military to ensure Maduro's downfall.
There's also a practical consideration here, too, because this isn't just the U.S. It's also the EU. It's Canada. There's the Lima Group, the regional bloc of the Americas. Most members of the Lima Group have supported Juan Guaido after he declared himself interim president. At the end of the day, I mean, Venezuela's neighbors need to do business with somebody in Caracas who is going to literally pick up the phone. Who are they supposed to call?
Well, the group that became the Lima Group tried to sanction Venezuela within the OAS. They weren't able to. Other countries did not go along with it. I think the position taken by Uruguay and by Mexico is a much more sane proposition. They've offered to negotiate. Again, because if we're betting on some sort of extra undemocratic or extrajudicial mechanism to unseat Maduro, the legacy will remain, and the legacy for Venezuela will be very dangerous. So I think that the only solution is to negotiate the process, because in the long term, if there isn't a consensus on how that transition happens, we'll be back to square one again with conflict, whether it's from the Chavistas or it is from the opposition. So there has to be some sort of middle ground formed.
Professor Salas, what's your sense? I know it's hard to generalize, but does the vast majority of Venezuelans, are they happy with Guaido?
It's not clear yet. People protest against Maduro, but they may not be for Guaido. They're not protesting against educational reform. They're not protesting against housing reform. They're not protesting against food subsidies. They're not protesting against the very social programs that in the past they've supported. So I think we have to be careful in the international community to recognize that there are multiple layers within this opposition. There are those who want Maduro out and revert Venezuela back to what it was before 1998. There are those from the left who want Maduro out because he hasn't fulfilled the promises and he's taken the country down a wrong path. And there are those who seek some sort of compromise, looking for that middle ground that can be created to assure that we're not back to the same exact position in a matter of months or a matter of years.
Venezuelan historian Miguel Tinker Salas is a professor at Pomona College. His latest book is Venezuela, What Everyone Needs to Know. Thank you very much, Miguel.
Thank you.
Ebola, a dangerous, potentially deadly disease. The latest outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo has a good news, bad news aspect to it. There is now a vaccine for Ebola, and it's working, saving lives. That's the good news. The bad news, the security situation in Congo, or the DRC as it's called, is not good at all. Armed conflict is making it difficult to deal with the current Ebola outbreak. The violence is preventing sick people from seeking treatment. Health workers have also been attacked.
North Kivu is undoubtedly the most difficult place we've ever had to battle Ebola before.
North Kivu is a province on the northeast border of the DRC. Dr. Stacey Mearns is there with the International Rescue Committee.
Last week, we recorded the highest number of cases in any single day since the outbreak started. And we've seen ongoing violence and attacks from armed rebel groups. So this underlying insecurity is directly impacting the response and making it very difficult to contain and control.
Yeah, I mean, North Kivu, we have to say, is one of the most violent places on earth. So how is the fighting between these rival militias making the life of healthcare workers like you in the face of Ebola more challenging?
On one hand, it's affecting the movement of individuals who have Ebola or people who've come into contact with cases of Ebola to actually get to where they need to be to receive care. And it's also affecting the movement of response workers. So that could be your vaccination teams, your safe burial teams, your surveillance teams. The insecurity is affecting their movement to get to where they need to be.
And I mean, what does the crisis look like on the ground? Are we looking at groups of people who are quarantined and can't move at all? And who's engaging with them?
So we don't have any widespread quarantine measures in place here, unlike we did in West Africa, in areas where we're seeing armed militia attacking. It's affecting the population to get out, to get support, and to get help. But it's also causing individuals to constantly be displaced from where they live. I do think there are things for us to be optimistic about. One is the vaccine. So far, teams have vaccinated over 65,000 people. If we didn't have the vaccine in this outbreak, we would be looking at case numbers of double, treble what they currently are. Prior to using the vaccine here, it had only been trialed in a very few studies previously in West Africa. So the exact numbers regarding how effective the vaccine is, that's information we currently don't know. But certainly by the end of this outbreak, we should have good data to support and strengthen that understanding.
Now, I hear that U.S. medical personnel are playing a pretty limited role in Congo. Why is that?
That's tied into the underlying insecurity in the area and the, you know, strict security protocols that a lot of U.S. government personnel have.
So is that really standing in the way of kind of properly dealing with the outbreak?
Agencies like the CDC, for example, have an enormous amount of expertise when it comes to Ebola. I think the restrictions, you know, the CDC have found innovative ways to contribute to the response by working closely with WHO, by having teams based in Kinshasa and supporting remotely. But I do think that, you know, given the current state of the outbreak, I think the more actors with the experience that the agencies like the CDC has on the ground would be very important.
There was an article, Dr. Mearns, in the magazine Foreign Policy recently, and it was headlined, "Ebola has gotten so bad, it's normal." And the argument was that international health responders are just playing whack-a-mole and Ebola is proving kind of impossible to control. Is there some truth in that?
By and large, when we respond to Ebola outbreaks, initially it is like a game of whack-a-mole, where we have to follow the outbreak as the outbreak evolves. What we need to get better at doing is to actually be one step ahead of the outbreak. So rather than, you know, throw all our resources and activities into areas that have active transmission and active cases of Ebola, is actually start to operate in neighboring areas to those areas and strengthen them with preparedness activities so that if Ebola was to move there, we can contain it much quicker.
Dr. Stacey Mearns with the International Rescue Committee speaking with us from North Kivu in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where she's dealing with the Ebola outbreak, along with a lot of healthcare workers. Dr. Mearns, thank you.
Thank you.
Citizen Lab is an internet watchdog group at the University of Toronto. Last time we spoke with them was in December. They were reporting that the Saudi government had been spying on Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi with the help of software from an Israeli company. That all happened before Khashoggi's murder in October. It is a wild story, and it gets more wild. After that report from Citizen Lab, researchers there say they became targets. John Scott Railton is one of those Citizen Lab researchers. He began by telling us about a phone call he got in mid-January.
Hello.
Bonsoir, Monsieur John Scott.
Ah, oui, c'est John. Je parle français, mais...
Well, the guy who called me shocked me immediately by speaking in French, which is a language I speak, but I don't make a big deal about it. And he pretended to be interested in what I had done for my original PhD work, which was flying kites with robotic cameras attached in Africa. And he presented himself as an international investor interested in using this technology. Unfortunately for them, we had sort of been expecting them to come because they had previously targeted one of my colleagues. And so as soon as this gentleman got in touch, we realized that they were trying to run an operation against us. And I played my role as an excited, you know, PhD student interested that somebody was finally paying attention to my work, which is anyone who knows PhD students knows is definitely a type. Unfortunately, Michel had the disadvantage that we already knew what he was doing.
So you called him Michel. That was the name he gave this person.
He represented himself as Michel Lambert, a French businessman with offices in Dakar and Paris.
So you agreed to meet with Michel in New York. Where did you meet? What happened?
So we met at Clément, which is a restaurant at the five-star Peninsula Hotel.
How are you? Welcome.
I came in mic'd up, and it's a long meeting over lunch. And during the meeting, for the first hour, Michel asked me biographical questions, bantered with me about Africa, bragged about his love of fine cigars, and tried to put me at my ease. He pivoted the conversation about an hour in, which is what I was waiting for, to start asking me very detailed questions about the Citizen Lab, and specifically our work on a spyware company named NSO Group.
Right, and NSO Group, this is the Israeli company, correct?
That's correct. And, you know, Citizen Lab has many projects, but Michel had only one line of questioning. He wanted to ask me questions about NSO Group. And, well, I have to tell you something quite funny about this. So Michel was working from cue cards, which were multicolored.
Wait a minute, he's sitting at this restaurant and he's got cue cards in front of him while you're having a conversation?
He has cue cards, which he explains as, you know, just an anachronistic feature of being a more senior gentleman. And these are three colors. He's got green cue cards, yellow cue cards, and red index cards. And during the get-to-know-you phase of the conversation, he's working from his green cards. And then when he starts asking questions about NSO and asking questions about whether our work is motivated by anti-Semitism and asking some other pretty provocative stuff, then he's on the red cue cards. He also asked me direct questions about what I knew about the case of Jamal Khashoggi and whether Jamal's telephone was indeed bugged by NSO Group.
I mean, aside from just the weirdness of this whole sit-down, what evidence did you have that these men were not who they said they were?
As soon as my colleague Bahar left the original meeting, which happened in December, again in a fancy hotel, in the Shangri-La Hotel in Toronto, we began digging into the online cover identity created for the individual who was present at that meeting. And we determined within minutes that we were looking at a creation rather than a real company. We were later able to confirm that, both on our side and with the help of the Associated Press, who we brought in shortly thereafter. From there, as soon as the individual named Michel got in touch with me, we were able to also quickly determine that not only was his background also fake, but it was constructed with the same techniques.
Okay, Marco, back with you here. To ask the question we're all wondering at this point, who exactly was behind this operation? When I spoke with John Scott Railton earlier today, he could not say, but that changed right before we were about to go on air. Here's an update John just sent us.
We've just learned today that the individual who identified himself as Michel and shared a lunch with me is actually named Aaron Almog Asulin, according to a report that just broke in the Israeli press. That report also says that the individual is known in the past to have worked with Black Cube. Now, the name Black Cube may be familiar to some of your listeners because it was the same firm that was hired by Harvey Weinstein to go after some of the women who had accused him of sexual harassment. The same firm was also implicated in the targeting of former Obama administration officials based on their work on the Iran deal.
That was John Scott Railton, one of those Citizen Lab researchers caught up in a nasty international dispute. We've reached out to Black Cube and asked the company for an official response. What you're about to hear is an audio clue for our next story. That's the moment when ice sheets on a lake expand and crash into each other to form a ridge. That thunderous crash was recorded by Shinto priests on the shores of Lake Suwa in Japan. They record it every year, in fact. Our colleagues at the BBC shared that sound today because it so happens that winter lake ice is in the news. According to a new study published in the journal Nature, more and more lakes around the globe are becoming ice-free during the winter because of warmer temperatures. That includes Japan's Lake Suwa. BBC environment correspondent Matt McGraw has been looking into this research from a team of scientists led by a professor from York University in Toronto.
What the scientists have done here is they've looked at existing number of lakes around the world that are in what they call intermittent phase. These are lakes that when the winter is really cold, they freeze. When the winter is not so cold, they thaw and you get clear water. And they've worked out that basically as temperatures rise in the next 20 years, we're going to see a doubling of the number of lakes that would be ice-free in the wintertime.
Okay, but so what if there are fewer lakes covered with ice in the winter? Who does that affect? Here's Matt McGraw again.
About 390 million people around the world are living within an hour of one of these lakes. And people use these for recreation. They use them for, you know, ice skating, ice fishing, lots of things like that. But they're also really important ecologically and for things like drinking water, for instance. And when you don't have ice in winter, an awful lot more of that water evaporates. You get impacts on toxic blooms. You get less fish. The fish don't reproduce as well when the lakes are warmer. So you get all these things happening and damaging the lakes. And the ability of people to cross from one area to another in many indigenous communities use the frozen lakes as roads in the wintertime. And when they're not there, what are they going to do for food, social contact? There's a lot of implications to the melting of these lakes.
The BBC's Matt McGraw. It is often hard for us to see the impact of climate change. It's often subtle, invisible. But in this case, with ice during the winter, it's cut and dry. It's either frozen or it's not. Dogs and Ukraine. Well, the name Chernobyl is synonymous with nuclear disaster. It's been almost 33 years since a nuclear plant in the Ukrainian city blew up, spreading radiation far and wide. Access to the exclusion zone is still restricted, but that hasn't stopped hundreds of dogs from living there, some 250 in the plant itself. Until recently, it was illegal to remove them from the site, but the Ukrainian government changed that. Lucas Hickson is the co-founder of the Clean Futures Fund. His group is helping to rescue the dogs of Chernobyl and put them up for adoption in the U.S. and Canada. So the first thing I think a lot of people are going to want to know is, Luke, are the dogs radioactive? Like if you adopt one, can they pass on radiation or radiation sickness to their new owners?
No, the dogs themselves are not radioactive. The concern that you would have is with some type of like superficial contamination that's picked up on their fur from living in this environment. Now, the dogs that we rescue are puppies, and we rescue them as soon as they are weaned from their mothers. And so at this point, they really don't explore the environment. They stay in the area where their mother has given birth to them and feeds them. And so we've actually never had a puppy that has posed any superficial contamination risk.
So how did you start this project?
I'm a radiation specialist. And so that's actually what first brought me to Chernobyl with my other co-founder, Eric Kambarian, in 2013. And I remember the first time that I stepped off of the train and looked around, and I was amazed to see six or seven stray dogs wandering around this area where the workers are released and where they enter the plant site. And everywhere we went through the site, we kept seeing more and more dogs. And this was just something that I had not expected. It really surprised me.
So how did the dogs become strays in the first place? I mean, the accident at Chernobyl happened in 1986.
So in 1986, when the residents of the 30-kilometer exclusion zone were evacuated, they were forced to leave everything in their life behind. Some of them were told that they could bring enough clothing and funds for two or three days. They told that they would be able to return, but they never were. The animals were left behind either in their houses or chained in the front yards. Sometimes the residents would leave signs on the doors that said, "My dog is inside. Please don't forget to feed him." Now, those animals that were left behind were left to fend for themselves. The Soviet military sent soldiers through the exclusion zone to kill what animals and livestock remained. But obviously, this is a very tough job for anyone with a compassionate heart to do, and many of these animals survived. And over the years, these dogs have continued having puppies.
What is the most heartwarming story you've heard about a Chernobyl puppy adoption?
Well, I can tell you from my perspective as well. So this is kind of a two-sided story. The dogs in the exclusion zone are largely pack mentality. You know, they build their own packs. In that pack, they have their hierarchy. So Chernobyl dogs, like the dog that I've adopted, Dva, they're very sensitive to other dogs. They're always trying to figure out where they fit in. And oftentimes, until they get to know the other animals, they're pretty timid. But this summer, we were able to adopt two puppies from the same litter, and they both went to homes in Ohio. And after about 4 or 5 months of being in the United States, these adoptive families found each other, and they decided to have a puppy play date. And I saw this great, incredible video where they brought these puppies together for the first time, two puppies from the same litter, and almost immediately they recognized each other, even though they probably hadn't seen each other in 4 or 5 months. And they just start running around and playing like puppies you would normally expect. And that was really incredible for me to really see that, because I know how sensitive they are to other animals. So to see their sibling and just to immediately fall right back into that puppy play, it was one of the best things I've seen.
That is a great story. Luke Hickson, founder of Clean Future Fund, getting adoptive families for the puppies of Chernobyl. Thank you for your time. Good on you for the work you're doing. And the dogs, thank you too.
Thank you so much, Marco. And thanks for having me on the show.
And a quick postscript. Lucas Hickson's work on behalf of dogs is not limited to Ukraine. When we reached him earlier today for that interview, here's where he said he was.
I'm in Iraq right now, so if the connection's a little spotty, my apologies.
It's actually quite clear. What are you doing in Iraq?
I'm actually rescuing some dogs for U.S. soldiers and transporting them back to be reunited with their new families in the U.S.
Wow. Are these dogs that these soldiers once knew and are attached to in some way?
Correct. So when the soldiers are based overseas, there's a lot of stray dogs that end up living around the bases. So the soldiers will make friends with the dogs. And then the soldier gets sent back home and the dogs are left behind. So there's an organization in the U.S. called SPCA International, and I'm a flight volunteer for them. So I'm one of the people that will fly over Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, help pick up the dogs, get them on the planes, and then bring them back to the States and reunite them with the soldiers and their families.
Very cool. Again, that was Lucas Hickson, co-founder of the Clean Futures Fund. That'll do it for us today. Hug your loved ones, the dogs that is, and don't forget to hug your human family too. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.